just want to thank you guys for giving me some of your time and letting me share this with you. To start off, Romans 8:2 says that the law of the spirit and life in Christ Jesus has set me free from the law of sin and death. I was born in 1986 in San Antonio, Texas. My family and I moved to Houston when I was 5 years old. Growing up, I have very few memories of my mother and father together. They divorced when I was very young, but the memories I do have were of a loving family. My dad was a truck driver. He made sure to be home with my sister and I every night to spend time with us. My mom would take care of us while dad was away at work. When my parents divorced, when I was young, it was very hard on me. I found that the world around me no longer made any sense, and I began to question who I was. Before the divorce, I was a happy kid, always curious about the world and the way things worked, with a million questions about things. I was content to make up my own stories and play by myself or with others, but I had changed after my mom was gone. By the time I was in third grade, I was no longer interested in school or making friends or asking questions, and my teacher, she had noticed the change in me. She pulled me from class one day, and she had been concerned and mentioned with tears in her eyes that she no longer could recognize me anymore, and that I'd become so sad, but she wanted to help me and be there for me. But I didn't really understand what that meant. Her words cut really deep to me that day. I know that she was genuinely concerned when she said that she didn't recognize me anymore, but that began the question of my life for the rest of my life. That became the deepest question of who am I and where do I belong? My family would have identified as Christian, going to church on Sundays, having small group services in the house. This was my experience of Christianity at home, though it often clashed with my experiences at school. I went to a Christian private school where religion was part of the study. I saw this as being strict, uncaring, uncompromising, rigorous, and at any point you were to slip out of line, a harsh punishment would be enforced. At home, my parents would practice their faith in completely different ways. My father being of the mind that I should come to believe whatever I would come to believe, he just hoped I would be a Christian, and the other experience of believe what I say or else. Ultimately, I would come to believe that since everyone seemed to have wildly varying views on God, Jesus, and faith itself, then it all must be a foolish lie. I decided that I was tired of being confused, angry, and scared, and that I would simply rebel against it all. I had also begun to develop a deep mistrust of religious people. Having been ostracized and bullied while in private school, the kids acted as if my family and I must have been some kind of cursed sinners for having gone through a divorce. I had become an angry and rebellious child. I had no interest in school or following any of the rules. I was constantly getting into trouble. Again, I couldn't identify the reasons why I was this way. But when I did get into trouble, I felt terrible for it and wished I could be better, but could never seem to be. All of this continued on until I was around 14 years old. I began to self-harm. I would repeatedly cut myself and hide it from others. I didn't understand why I was doing this, but it seemed to kind of help some of the pain that was building deep inside of me, temporarily relieving me of some of what I was feeling. And I couldn't share this with anybody. I couldn't share the way I was really feeling because I'd already felt like, you know, that was kind of an impossibility. As I got older, you know, the kids that I hung out with in school would just kind of egg me on to even worse behavior and more self-destructive tendencies. Nothing helped. I could go to counseling, have conversations with adults. These never helped me. My peers simply egged me on. It's even more self-harm and destructive behavior. I then began to use drugs and become sexually active at the age of 15, and this would continue on for many years. Eventually, my father would remove me from high school, as it really wasn't going anywhere for me, and I wasn't even trying at that point. And I was given a choice of which branch of the military I would be going into. And by the time I was 17 years old, I was shipped off to Cape May, New Jersey for Coast Guard training. I only spent a short time because I was injured and then sent home. I had suffered a third-degree sprain in my ankle. And having kind of been in between formation training, I decided that I wasn't going to go to the DHE and tell them that I had hurt my ankle and spent 2 days walking around with it without taking my boot off. And then when I took my boot off, it exploded, essentially. So they were like, oh man, you messed it up bad. So I enjoyed my time in the Coast Guard and felt a sense of purpose and direction, like I had a reason for being alive and could actually become a functional person. But when I lost that, I went into an even deeper spiral of depression and destructive behavior. I continued to grow darker and darker when I came back home. I just wasn't interested in simply harming myself any longer. And now I had a death wish. So I started using drugs even harder than before and putting myself in dangerous situations, deliberately trying to see how far I could take it. This period of my life was such a blur, as I was on drugs nearly 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and there are months of my life that I have no memory of. And this resulted in the first time I overdosed, the results of which just made me spiral even more out of control. First off, I was 19 years old when one night after leaving a drug-fueled party, I would black out in my vehicle and run through a red light, causing someone to smash into my car. I had no idea what happened. All I can remember is that I came to in the vehicle and tried to start the car, but that didn't work. In confusion, I began walking down the side of the road, and within moments, I was surrounded by police vehicles, all questioning me about what I was doing, where I was going, and why I just caused a wreck. I would end up in jail facing a felony charge of reckless driving. And though the other driver hit my car, I was at fault, first of all, for obviously running the red light and the drugs that they found in my system. And I was pretty forthcoming with that. It's clearly I was on a lot of drugs that night. I was eventually sentenced to 8 years of probation and many hundreds of hours of community service in lieu of the judge's desire to send me to the maximum penalty of 15 years in state jail. This period of my life was very difficult, as I could not drive and I had to walk everywhere for work and to community service. It didn't matter what time of year it was, whether it was raining or shining. I spent many years of this sentence just trying to get by with whatever I could, but I felt guilty for my mistakes and was trying my hardest to hide from the pain. I did not wish to go to state jail for up to 15 years, but I would drink as much as I could because it was easier to get by with while on probation. I would eventually relapse, though, while still on probation, to be caught for that. And by the grace of God, I was not sent to jail. They were basically ready. Any offenses that you make while on probation, you're going to be going to prison. But rather, I was ordered by the court to continue mental health supervision and medication. The doctors would give me the drugs I wanted to do without me getting in trouble, but I would continue to get worse instead of better. Eventually, by the time I was 21 years old, I had attempted suicide many times, having also overdosed on at least 4 occasions, at one point badly enough that my heart stopped for up to 15 minutes, but I was resuscitated on the way to the hospital. I, of course, don't remember any of this, but at some point I came to in the hospital with a nurse drawing blood, telling me how lucky I was to be alive, and that I had barely made it. And of course, my reaction to this was that if I had been clinically dead for up to 15 minutes, why don't I remember anything? Where was the bright light or the pearly gates that I was always told about? This only stood to reinforce my feelings that if there was a God, he simply didn't care enough to make himself known to me. Therefore, he must not exist, as I had only been told, and I only grew darker and darker. I would continue to make things work out on my own, or try to at least, but eventually every relationship would become a disaster, and I felt more alone than ever. In 2009, I'd begun to plan out a suicide that I knew was going to be elaborate enough that it would end my life for sure. Events had been going on for long enough that I could no longer stand it, despairing of life and feelings of hopelessness. Yet, on March 13, 2009, something gripped me that morning. I woke up that morning and I knew that unless God answered my prayers, that I would be dead. Something was going on inside my heart for the first time. And surprisingly, I began to pray and ask God to please, please answer my prayer. It's really the first time in my entire life that I really prayed. Like, I pretty much felt that it was all bullshit until that point. I knew that something was gripping me that morning, and I said, God, I'm going to kill myself. I can't seem to escape this place that I've been in. I'm so tired. I can't get better where I am. I need a place to go and get sober. Please, if you are real, answer me and tell me you have a place for me. And of course, not long after praying this, about an hour or so, I got a phone call from a family member. And she had been concerned for me, and she'd been praying, and she felt like she should give me a call that morning. And she knew it was God, because any other time she tried to call me and give me any religious stuff, I would just hang right up on her. But she'd been looking at outreaches around Houston that I could go to and live among godly men and get sober. She knew she needed to call me and tell me this. And I heard the words over the answering machine, because I wasn't going to answer the phone. It's the religious lady, you know. But I heard her on the answering machine, and she said, you know, I was praying this morning, and I felt like God told me to call you up and tell you that God has a place for you to go. And I freaked out. God had answered my prayer in exactly the same way that I begged him to answer that prayer that morning. So once I heard these words, I believe God has a place for you to go, I answered, yes, I will go. And I fell on my knees and asked Jesus into my heart that very day. On March 13, 2009, I packed my bag and left to spend 2 years in the outreach. This period of time was miraculous. Doors began to open that I could never have imagined opening. The court even forgave the probation fees while I was there, among many other answered prayers. I met a man named Ray DeLaywell in the outreach, and he would give Bible studies, and on a daily basis, he would tell me 2 Peter 1:1. To those two who through the righteousness of our God and Savior Jesus Christ have received a faith as precious as ours. I was given this faith not because of what I had done, which clearly none of it deserved the gift of faith in God. I was given this precious gift because of what God did in sending Jesus Christ, his Son, to live among us and to show us the way and then to die on the cross. I could not understand that even though Jesus died on the cross for my sins, that I began to understand that this was the plan for redemption from the very beginning, that I was never so lost that God couldn't find me. That God hadn't lost us in the garden, we were called, when he called out our names, asking us for where we were. And he had not sent us from that paradise because simply to punish us for not living up to his standards. We could not live up to those standards. As long as we had lived the way that we would never be able to. I was living my life ashamed of my nakedness, seeing that what I was doing was not only hurting myself, but others. I saw the tears of my family and my friends and the people that cared about me for the first time and realized that what I've been doing to myself, I've been doing to them. There's so much more to this story, but the most important thing that I can say is that God has gone the ultimate length to show us his love. And until we are transformed in our minds, we will not be able to see anything other than our own nakedness and shame. Lamentations 3:19 and 20 says, I remember my affliction and my wandering, the bitterness and the gall. I well remember them, and my soul is downcast within me. Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope, because of the Lord's great love we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail. What I've been experiencing for all these years was me trying to make it work on my own. And I had until that point not been ashamed of my own nakedness. I couldn't. There was no conviction inside of me. The Holy Spirit didn't exist in me. And so no shame could come. All I could do was just get worse and worse. But because of his great love, I was able to escape that. The only reasonable escape before then would have been my own death. But in an ironic sort of way, we're asked to die so that Christ can live in us. But see, God does want to give us a life of abundance. This we cannot earn, but it is a gift that is given to us because God is love. The truth is that nothing we do deserves this gift. But one thing that God certainly knows is what he is doing. And he saw the very day that I would be broken enough for him to give me this gift. Psalm 51:17 says, my sacrifice, O God, is a broken spirit and a broken and contrite heart. God, you will not despise. And that's where I was. I began to realize that God says that whom he loves, he disciplines and chastens as a son. And my son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline and do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines the one he loves. See, how could God love me? You know, when I started asking myself that question, how could God love me the way that I was at that time? God loved me not because of me, but because of himself. He couldn't help himself but love us. It doesn't matter where we are or what we do. He does not despise us, and though we can do nothing to earn this grace, it is freely given. There are not words in this world eloquent enough to prove this to a man, but until we see the filth of life that we live in and are tired of being ashamed, the arms of Jesus are always wide open. He was in a similar state on the cross, and he can sympathize, and even more so because he was blameless. What has continuously proved his love for me is that he treats me like a son because I am a son. I spent a few years in ministry after leaving the outreach, going from church to church, kind of preaching and teaching and sharing my testimony. I did street ministry and contact evangelism for many years also, but even though I had been transformed and now was following after a calling, something was still missing. I had not been discipled. I could tell you all the answers and respond with the things that I was told were important. But when chaos came calling into my life again around 2014, 2015, I found that that same scared little boy who had existed before 2009 was still there. And so I got married in 2014. In 2016, I was beginning to go through a divorce. I once again found myself crying out to God for answers. Why was all this happening to me? Had I not followed after you like you wanted me to? It was around this time that I'd really started talking with Rick and going on retreats, doing Operation Timothy. See, Rick had always been reaching out to me for a long time, but never really being overbearing or anything. He was just always there when I needed him. I started to see the importance of discipleship, that what had gone wrong in my marriage was a direct result of not having been discipled. No father had ever come along in life and walked with me. Of course, Rick had always been willing to do so. So I responded to this, and eventually we would start to meet up weekly. And sure, there were ups and downs, but this was the most important step I would take since my salvation, was to stick with discipleship. I had looked for answers and guidance in a lot of people, but none of them were fathers. They could teach me as Ray DeLay had done back in the outreach, but not a single one of them could roll up their sleeves and be determined to stay with me through whatever life would bring. And so that's what I knew that was important. I knew discipleship was the most important step beyond salvation. There are people that God has brought into my life, friends and acquaintances that I would begin to pray about and continue to maintain relationships with. See, I had never done this before. It's the first time in my life that I've ever had people there that I've actually sat with through their own, you know, chaos and been able to really disciple and reach out to. But of course, this started off with Rick telling me that I should disciple these men, and I thought he was just a nutcase. I was like, well, what a mess I am, you know, how could I possibly do that? But John 15:13 says, greater love has no man than this, than to lay his life down for his friends. So whatever I thought of myself didn't matter. I had realized that even though I spent all that time doing street ministry, evangelism, preaching from church to church, I never saw any real lasting fruit from it. It hasn't been until I responded to the call of discipleship that it became evident in my own life, and furthermore in the lives of others. I've written this testimony so many times, it's about to drive me crazy, to be honest, and I have been questioning what the most important thing to say is. And I realized that it is really important, so I want to leave with this, that it doesn't matter where you are, what you have done, what you believe, or what you do not believe, but you are loved by God because He is love. That while we live our lives only to ourselves, we can never come to be filled with an abundant life. But that abundant life starts when we respond to the question of our hearts and not of our minds, of who Jesus is and why did He die for us. Look at the world around and see that it's always dying, that people kill each other and hurt each other to get ahead in life or to have their own way. But Jesus died not only for the worst of us, but also for the best. He took our rightful place in that punishment. And I ask you to ponder what this means. Romans 5:7-8. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous person, though for a good person someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates His own love for us in this, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. In Galatians 2:20-21, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And this life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave Himself for me. I do not set aside the grace of God, for if righteousness comes through the law, then Christ died in vain. Thank you.